Join Sam and Will as they bring the Bible's stories to life through historical evidence and try not to feel out of place in a car garage, all while bringing you Under the Hood.
Welcome to Under the Hood. I'm your host, Will. I'm here alongside Sam. Sam, what are we talking about today?
Today, we're going to be taking a look at Herod the Great, kind of a biographical sketch. This is a guy that shows up in the gospel. He's in Matthew. He's in Luke. Right at the beginning, this is the guy that is most famous for doing something really, really atrocious. What is it?
He slaughters all the babies of Bethlehem.
He orders the slaughter of all the babies of Bethlehem. But he's dies not long after Jesus is born. Like, Jesus will be a toddler, you know, a pretty young kid when Herod dies. And it's like, who is this guy? Where does he come from? And it turns out there's actually a lot of historical evidence that gives us a picture into the mind of this guy, how he operated, why he was so influential during Jesus's times. And so we're going to dive into who is this guy.
Because he's one of those guys that shows up in the Bible, but is not talked a lot about in the Bible. But he's an interesting guy that we know a lot about outside of the Bible.
That's right. So you have Herod the Great, and then we're going to talk about how he has other Herods to follow after him as a family name that are going to be influential throughout the rest of the Bible. So it'll be one of his sons that is holding the trial for Jesus when Pilate sends him to Herod. That'll be Herod the Great's son. Archelaus, there's different Herods that govern over different areas. But Herod the Great is the first one who governs over all of the region.
Okay, so let's start there. Why is he called the Great?
Well, this is actually a title that's given to him posthumously. So after he's dead, it's not like he was walking around and everyone's
the Great.
Herod, yeah, you're so great. And there's different theories as to why, because when you learn about Herod, nobody really liked him. Like, his countrymen really despised him, actually. Only the people that he enriched were really in his camp. But he did some pretty phenomenal things. Like, he architecturally, his building projects are still around in Israel. I mean, we've been there.
They're amazing.
We've seen some amazing stuff that he did. But as a human being, in addition to the slaughter of the innocents, which is the killing the babies in Bethlehem, this guy's a maniac. I mean, if he had more power and more extent, he would have probably been one of the worst tyrants in the history of man. His view of the sanctity of life was pretty bad. I mean, the way he treated his own family, it was really dangerous to be close to Herod. You probably weren't going to be around long. And that's just the way he is. So why is he called great? Because he did a lot of great things. With stuff, he was amazing. With human beings, he was atrocious.
So the stuff that lasted, everyone's like, okay, we're looking back and we see his beautiful buildings.
That's right.
Awesome. But we don't know exactly what all that took place.
That's right. And so when he dies, we're going to get into how he came to power and some of what he did to maintain that power. Like, he was ruthless. When he dies, all of his territories are then divided into what's called tetrarchs.
Okay.
And so his sons and they take over the area. So tetrarch literally means four rulers. And so he's going to have Herod Archelaus that takes over Judea, which is the region of Jerusalem. You have Antipas. That's the one that you hear about all through the Gospels. He's the one that will behead John the Baptist.
Okay.
He's also the one that Jesus appears before. He's the one that Jesus calls a fox. He's really influential later on in the Gospels. But you also have Philip, which is mentioned in the Gospels. Remember when John the Baptist is accusing Herod Antipas of being, you know, out of line because he married his brother's
wife.
I mean, this family is. And so that's another one. But there was also a relative named Salome who governed like smaller territories and villages. And so all in, they kind of take over his thing. But I want to talk for a moment about like what Herod did that was great before we tear this guy apart and show why he's a monster. His building projects were amazing. So, like, you can still go there, see the ruins of some of his stuff. I mean, the temple is gone. Herod's temple was gone. But to understand how massive this project was, we've been there. We've gone underground of Jerusalem, walked on the old marble tiles that were in Jerusalem. I mean, you can imagine if you just put that to scale how beautiful this renovation would have been. Because the second temple, after the first one, Solomon's temple was destroyed. When they rebuilt the second temple, it made people cry because it was so womp womp. And so Herod's like, I'm going to rebuild this thing to be grand and massive. And when he built it, people were amazed. And he had retaining walls around the Temple Mount that used stones weighing 570 tons apiece. Just to give you some idea of scale here. And it was a marvel. People looked at Herod's temple and it was stunning. This would have been the temple that Jesus goes to visit. Then you go to Caesarea Maritima, which is on the coast. We've also been there. And this is where Herod did something that a lot of people said should have been like a wonder of the world, where he took volcanic ash from Italy, put it in boxes, went out into the sea and sank them so that he built basically like a concrete wall that came up and blocked the currents, blocked the waves. And he made a port out in the middle of the sea that became a huge destination for merchants. And everybody marvels at like, this was an innovation of its time. And then he built the grand palaces for the Roman officials, along with pagan, you know, temples there, a hippodrome where they raced horses. I mean, building aqueducts. This guy was amazing. That whole city, you can still go there and see it. Amazing. He built Masada. Also crazy impressive. Remember going there?
Yeah.
What's Masada?
It's on top of a mountain. It's crazy. It's like we had the option of either riding up or some people like run up and walk up. And I'm like, that's absolutely insane. I'm looking crazy at it like we're taking the train or whatever. That thing was a gondola.
But yeah, you go up there. It's huge on the high of top of a mountain that he just kind of levels out, builds a fortress on there. And the crazy part is on the north side of the mountain, into the actual mountain, he builds his palace, like carved into it. And it's got like saunas and bathhouses and heated flooring. And I mean, and it's always in the shade. So his ability to build things was absolutely amazing. And he did all this on a mountain that's out in the middle of the desert.
You look around, there's just nothing.
Yeah. But this place is like an oasis. It's this glorious thing. And it's got a really cool history that you can look at on your own. Herodium, he reshapes a mountain to build a circular palace fortress on top of it, shaves off the sides so that it's like this perfectly round mountain that you can see for miles. And he does this mountain, these mountaintop fortresses all over the place. So Alexandria, Machaerus, which is where John the Baptist will be imprisoned and ultimately beheaded, Cyprus, Jericho palaces with gardens and swimming pools and aqueducts and all this advanced water engineering that was amazing for one of the driest regions on the earth. And Herod is just doing this stuff. The Antonia fortress that was in Jerusalem that kind of oversaw and allowed them soldiers to have a view of all of Jerusalem to keep everything in order. So like you can go there, and beyond that, there's so many other things, gymnasiums and theaters and hippodromes. And this guy was prolific in building. But guess how he got all that money to do those projects?
Took it all.
He taxed the people into the dirt. Mm-hmm. And so did the people love that?
No.
I mean, they love looking at the buildings and being like, oh my goodness, look at Jerusalem and how amazing these buildings are. And look at all the building projects. But at the same time, he's going and being like, okay, you're a farmer. Here, I need taxes. And if you don't pay your taxes, guess what's coming? I'm taking all your land. And so he's a very oppressive figure. Is the average person living in Judea and Galilee utterly hated this guy. And for more reasons than just his cruelty.
Yeah, no one would have liked looking at these beautiful palaces that they can't use that their money built. Mm-hmm. It's one where it's like, okay, I don't want to do this anymore. I opt out.
Yeah. And so you had the loyalists around him that were actually called Herodians. You find them in the Bible as well, where they come and they're asking, should we pay taxes? Like, I mean, that's their big deal. But that's it. Outside of that, he didn't have many friends. And part of the reason for that is his legacy. He had a father who was an Idumean, which is an Edomite, right? So where's that come from? That's the line of Esau. And then his mother was an Arab. And so you had somebody who didn't have a Jewish bloodline. He's coming from the line of Esau and Ishmael. And so when he shows up in Jerusalem and he's like, oh, I'm the king of the Jews. Everybody's like, no, you're not. Like our kings are supposed to come from the line of David. You're not that guy. And so you're an outsider playing pretend so that you can have power here. Mm-hmm. And so even his bloodline made him somebody that Jerusalem was never going to accept, which I think probably only heightened and
exasperated
dislike of the people.
So how does he come to power then?
Well, he's part of a family that is like a political opportunist. His dad was named Antipater. And when the Romans conquer Jerusalem, so Jerusalem at this point is coming out of a period of independence. There are civil wars, they're infighting. And a guy named Pompey, who's a Roman general in 63 BC, so century or decades before Jesus comes along, sees the vulnerabilities and just takes Jerusalem. So he conquers Jerusalem. And his dad, Herod's dad, Antipater, aligns himself with Rome, scores all kinds of benefits. They come to him. And Rome had abolished the title of king in Israel. But he allows him to appoint the high priest. Julius Caesar comes along and makes Antipater the governor over all of Judea, governing everything, gives Roman citizenship to the entire family, including Herod. And so now Herod's stock, he's like hanging out with Mark Antony when he's younger. And so his stock is raising up, right? And so when he's 26 years old, in the middle of all this political turmoil, the people of Galilee says, we're not paying taxes to Rome. Hmm. And so Rome comes to Herod and says, you want to prove yourself?
Get the taxes.
Here's some military. Go put down this tax revolt hard. And so Herod does. I mean, he's ruthless. And he brings them into submission. And all of a sudden, Rome's like, this guy can do it. Like, he's not loyal. He doesn't, you know, treat people with soft gloves. He brings the authority of Rome to bear. We can trust this guy. He's on our side, even against, quote unquote, his own people. And so 6 years later, Mark Antony formally names Herod as the Tetrarch of Galilee, giving him official Roman authority. Oh, he's running in all the elite circles. But then in 40 BC, just following the story, Herod is looking good, climbing, and all of a sudden, the empire to the east, the Parthians, say they align with the local Jews who do not like Rome, and they overthrow the power structure. And they're like, we're going to go back and we're going to give you the people you want to be in charge. Herod's like, this is not good for me. And so he runs basically for his life, goes back to Rome. And when he gets there, he's like, everybody's turning on you. Rome is thrown upside down. You want somebody to go in there who's going to rule and protect Rome's interest? Make me king. Mm. Mark Antony's like, this guy's for real.
Yeah.
So guess what? Without having any local support in Israel, Rome's like, okay, well, if they're overthrowing all of our people, we need somebody in there who can lay claim to it.
And there's a fight involved.
And they name him king of the Jews with no popular support, even when he's not governing there. But he goes back with a Roman army and smashes them. I mean, he puts them down. And now the very people that he's just slaughtered, he's got to govern over as king of the Jews. So guess how they feel about him after a 3-year war where he's killing all of them.
Yeah, their brothers, their fathers are all dead. And it's like, now this guy's our leader?
This Edomite, non-Jew, Arab, half Edomite, half Arab is going to be our king? Like, absolutely not. But they can't do anything about it because he governs with an iron fist.
So when you say he ruled with an iron fist, what exactly did that look like in that instance?
Anybody that stood up against him or Rome's interest, he just put to death. So, like, remember how the Parthians come and they're like, we're going to help you put in your own guys? Well, he goes to that guy, this beloved guy, whose name is Antigonus II Mattathias, and he executes him. Ooh. You're done. And so all the people watch their beloved king, gone, killed. Then he goes to 45 different loyalists that were in the aristocratic level, all killed. He executed the former high priest on false charges of treason, right? Oof. Being a threat to power. And he reigns over this region, and anybody that stands against him, any negative opinion, guess what? You found yourself being murdered because Herod would not allow that at all. He executed this, you know, the Sanhedrin?
Yeah.
So in Jerusalem and all of the Jewish circles, the governing body of elders that governed over the Jewish religious matters was called the Sanhedrin. So he goes to them and executes them. So there's the historian Josephus claimed, listen to this, that Herod slew all but one member of the Sanhedrin. So in a group of 70,
wow,
one of them lived. That's according to Josephus, if we take him at his word. And so murder and intimidation, he recreates the priestly class to be loyal to him, which, by the way, the Sanhedrin's filled with Sadducees. So when Jesus comes along, the Pharisees are very much about pro-Israel, you know, let's make Israel great again. You know, it's all the traditions and everything else. The Sadducees are all very, very loyal to foreign influence. They're far more liberal. They don't believe in the supernatural. Why? Because the people that were restocked in the power class on the Sanhedrin were put on there by Herod. Now, this is going to be several decades before Jesus. But you see, he's shaping the power structures to not really put God first. Mm. It's, no. Remember who you serve. You may be a priest, but if you want to live.
Yeah, Rome's in charge.
You serve me in Rome. And so at the end of the day, scholars will say that Herod murdered thousands of people. during his brutal and tyrannical reign. To reign over just such a small territory, to kill thousands, like, that's a big deal. And he has 10 wives during his lifetime, according to historians. And he's using these marriages to build, like, personal advantages and political...
They're power marriages.
That's right. So, like, one example of this is he's like, how do I get this local Jewish population to like me that's just slaughtered all of their people, killed their favorite kings, not of their bloodline? And so he marries a woman whose name is Mariamne the First, who's the granddaughter of two former high priests. So he's like, he's looking for who's got the best credentials, the pedigree, two high priests, and this granddaughter of two high priests. Like, you can't get much more Jewish than that. So he marries her. But the problem is she doesn't like him, right? And so when he realizes that and figures out, or at least believes that she's conspiring against to overthrow him, he has her accused of adultery and treason. And so guess what happens to her? She's going to be executed. And then he executes her mother for conspiring against him. And then he executes the two sons that he had with her, strangling them both to death. He also has his son Antipater executed. Like, this guy
is paranoid, at least.
It doesn't matter. Like, it doesn't matter if you're distant, if you're a high priest, if you're a political enemy, or you're his son or wife or mother-in-law. Like, you are entirely unsafe around him. And there was this a great quote by Emperor Augustus, Caesar Augustus, who says, it's better to be Herod's pig than his son.
Oof.
And the words in Greek are very similar, so it sounds like a play on words. But it's better to be Herod's pig than his son. Why? Because Herod wanted to pretend that he was a good Jew. So if you were a pig...
Oh, you're safe because he won't kill you to eat you.
Because he's too Jewish to kill a pig.
But his son is on the chopping block.
But I'll kill my own son. Like, that's the conundrum of Herod. He has no value of human life. And so, like, one of the instances that Josephus writes about is he's in the temple. He had placed an eagle, which is emblematic of Rome, right, on the temple gate. And so when he's... A bunch of zealots come along and they're like, you can't have that on the temple. The temple is holy place. You can't do that. So they tear it down and they chop it up and all this stuff. And this is what Josephus writes about in the aftermath. He says, they pulled down the eagle and cut it into pieces with axes while a great number of the people were in the temple. Well, soldiers caught no fewer than 40 of these young men who had the courage to stay behind when the rest ran away. And when the king, Herod, had ordered them to be bound, he sent them to Jericho, called together the principal men among the Jews. Herod deprived Matthias of his high priesthood. He burnt the other Matthias, who had raised the sedition, with his companions alive. So he rounds up these 40 men along with high priest, burns them alive.
Wow.
Like, you mess with something that I put up, my decoration, I'll burn you alive. And so he just had this reputation, like, you did not mess with him. He had secret police, underground informant networks. He used torture. Like, this guy and anybody who stood against him ended up dying. And so another thing that's pretty wild about him that kind of colors, like, I want you to think about the religious institutions that Jesus is walking into. This guy used the office of high priest like a political appointment.
Which,
like,
is the highest religious position.
That's it. This is the one who is in charge of all of the sacred feasts, all the temple sacrifices, everything else. And so during his reign, he appointed 7 different high priests, had some of them murdered. One of them guys was like, he appointed foreigners, like, which is crazy because you had to be from the tribe of Levi. You had to be from the line of Aaron. Like, and he's appointing a guy whose name is Ananelis of Babylon. Like, he doesn't care, infuriating the Jews. And in one instance, he even drowns one of the high priests, who's the brother of the wife that he killed, right? The Jewish wife that he killed. And so he even tried to raid King David's tomb to see if there was gold in it. Like, the history of this guy is ruthless and nasty. And so now when you hear, this is the guy that when he hears of a rival king being born, when the wise men show up in Matthew chapter 2, and they're like, we've heard a king has been born and we're here to worship him. Herod's like, really? And so let's just read that passage.
Yeah, because that's not so crazy of a jump now, because in the Bible you come to and you're like, now this guy wants to slaughter all of the children of this town because he hears about a rival king who's come onto the scene. But now you're like, this is just what this guy did.
Yeah. He kills his own sons. He's not going to have any qualms about killing
some babies in Bethlehem.
That's it. Like, I mean, just none at all. And so this is the account of Matthew 2. It says, now, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem saying, where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we saw his star when it rose, and we've come to worship him. So they're not just coming to worship, or not just coming to honor a king. They're coming to worship, which means they believe this king is God, right? And so he's hearing this. And when Herod heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him, which is kind of meant to be a funny line. Because you can imagine this guy's so stinking paranoid and crazy that when everybody around him hears that somebody's mentioning a rival king, all of Jerusalem's going, oh no.
Yeah, we got to hide.
Yeah, because he's about to lose his mind and some people are dying. There's no doubt about it. So he was troubled in all Jerusalem with him, and assembling all the chief priests and scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Christ was to be born. And they told him, in Bethlehem of Judea, for so it is written by the prophet. And this is Micah 5:2. And you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means the least among the rulers of Judah, for from you it shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel. So Herod takes the wise men, says, I want you to go find him, and when you figure out where he is, come tell me so that I too may worship him. But they're told by God, don't go back to him. And when Herod saw that he had been tricked by the wise men, he became furious, and he sent and killed all the male children in Bethlehem and in all that region who were 2 years old or under, according to the time that he had ascertained from the wise men. And so, like, there's no record of this happening, but the thing that's interesting is Bethlehem is least among the clans of Judah, right? It's a tiny little village. And so if you think, like, I've looked at models of this, like, okay, let's say that their population, which is in a few hundred.
Yeah, like how many children would there
be? How many kids under two? It would have been like, you know, less than 10 or a dozen kids. This wouldn't have registered on Herod's death toll, from a tiny little town with seemingly insignificant, no nobles, no priests, no major insurrectionist. He's taking kids. This would not have registered.
Yeah,
Herod shows you his maniacal evils even more.
Yeah, Herod has enough high-profile executions to talk about.
Yeah, that's it.
This one would have just slid under the radar and just not been known.
Yeah, that's it. And so, like, the spiritual application of this that I love is you have three different responses to the coming of Jesus. One is wise men who travel hundreds of miles and will do anything to get there to a baby that can do nothing for him just because they want to pour themselves out to worship him. And that's the response, you know, you hope we all have. Then you have the religious leaders that are like 7 miles that way in Bethlehem.
Yeah, we knew he was there.
Yeah, the Messiah of the world. Like, here's somebody they've been waiting on for thousands of years. It shows up and they can't walk 7 miles to go check it out. And that's just like the person who's all about religion but not worship. And that's a dangerous place to be. And then you have Herod, who hears of a rival to the throne. And you get angry and you say, I will not share the throne with anyone. And you go on a campaign to get rid of it. And that's in all of us too, right? And so it's a good measurement tool to say, which of those three am I? Am I the one that will go, you know, through all kinds of things to get to Jesus, no matter what? And the reality is he's available to us. We don't have to go hundreds of miles anymore. Yeah. He dwells in us. His communion is rightly available to us. Or are we so religious? It's like, you know, yeah, I know all this stuff. I don't need to be with him. Or is it, I am in charge of my life. Get away from me, God. So anyway, Herod dies, and Josephus writes about how he dies. It's not a pleasant death, but it's
kind of fitting to the life he lived.
Yeah. And some of him wonders, like, does Josephus exaggerate this? Because it's pretty wild. He says his entrails were also ulcerated, which means he's internally bleeding with ulcers and everything else. And the chief violence of his pain lay on his colon. So he can't, like, every time he goes to the bathroom, lots of, you can imagine. An aqueous and transparent liquor also had settled itself about his feet. So he's just rotting. And a like matter afflicted him at the bottom of his belly. Nay, further, his privy member was putrefied and produced worms when he sat upright. He had a difficulty of breathing, which was very loathsome on account of the stench of his breath and the quickness of its return. So he's dying. And he also had convulsions in all parts of his body. And in typical Herod fashion, you know what he does when he's approaching death?
Probably hurt somebody, imprisoned someone.
He urges his team, round up all the prominent Jewish religious leaders, imprison them in Jericho's Hippodrome, and when I die, I want all of them slaughtered so that when I die, Israel mourns. He knows they're not going to mourn for him.
So he's going to make a sad thing happen during
the same
time. But it's
going to be sad because I'm going to take the people you do love and I want them killed. But his sister Salome ignored the order. And Herod died in Jericho. He's buried at Herodium, which is the circular hilltop fortress. We have his tomb. And you can go there and see some of the stuff from Herodium. It's pretty fantastic. But that is Herod the Great. A very real figure, a very troubled figure, and one that fits the biblical narrative of him slaughtering babies with not an ounce of conscience.
Yeah, that is so fascinating. His architecture survived. And now when you match his history up, it is kind of a mixed bag of a life.
Yeah. He's an evil person, sadly. You know, and as bleak and awful as that is, you know, Herod is going to die as Jesus is being born. And within a few decades, Jesus launches his public ministry. And, you know, this is the King of Kings. And how different are the two? You know, when you have a people that have been trained that this is what a king looks like, he is merciless and he's only self-interested and he will make everyone else die before he ever gives up reign or his own power or his own privilege. What a beautiful contrast that Jesus then presents, because he's the king that comes and says, no. I'll disadvantage myself so that you can have it all. I will lay down my power and privilege so that you can become sons of the king, so that you can be exalted, so that you get an everlasting inheritance, so that you are made perfect and all of these things. And it's like, if you look, I mean, they're the antithesis of one another. And praise God, because he is God. He could be cruel and there's absolutely nothing that we could do about it. And yet our God is humble and kind, and he comes and he pours himself out, and he is the farthest thing from a Herod-type figure. Thank you, Lord.
Amen to that.
Yeah. So anyway, I want to thank you so much for watching. Join us next time as we go into another story in the Bible.
Don't forget to like and subscribe. We'd love you checked out some other content we have. You can find that at sunlitstudios.com.